the land of the rising scrum on Off the Ball.
Yes, it's time now for episode 4 of Land of the Rising Scrum with me, Neil Tracy, as we continue our countdown through every team at the 2019 Rugby World Cup in Japan. So far, we've looked at Scotland, Japan and Russia. You can listen back to all those episodes on offtheball.com or watch back on our YouTube channel as well. This week, we're finishing off Ireland's Pool A opponents with Samoa, who've played in all but one running of the tournament, reaching the quarterfinals in 1991 and 1995, but they have struggled in recent tournaments as well. Joining me now on the line is a journalist based in Samoa with the Samoa Observer, Thomas Airy. Thomas, thanks a million for joining us tonight. Quite late where you are at the moment, isn't it?
Yeah, it's 10 o'clock at night, but it's not too bad. I'm glad to be on the show.
You're from New Zealand as well, I understand. Yeah, how long have you been in Samoa?
I've been here since November last year, so not too long, but I'm starting to get used to the place.
Yeah, like it's a place for people on our side of the world we've probably seen lots of pictures of, but not too many of us have really been over there. What's the, you know, what's life like over there? What's life like in Samoa?
It's hot, for a start. I guess that sort of everything like comes out of that. It's a tough life for some people, like a simple sort of life, I guess. Like people will have, everyone has like their own family land, and then it's like up to you sort of what you do with it. So there's not much like paying rent or anything like that. But yeah, people like start businesses selling produce or like start a taxi stand, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. We associate it obviously with being a rugby mad nation. Are we right in saying that?
Yeah. It's impossible to avoid, I think, in New Zealand. Mm-hmm. And like much the same in Samoa, I found as well.
Mm-hmm. And like obviously their Samoa's Rugby World Cup history, it almost follows the lines of the kind of gulf that's emerging between the tier one nations and the tier two nations in the early runnings of it, you know, getting to a couple of quarterfinals. 1991 particularly was what everyone would have thought was the watershed one, beating Wales over India in Great Britain. And then in more recent years, 99, just a quarterfinal playoff, that becomes just pool stage exits from there on in, really. Like, it's just kind of shown up that year on year, tournament on tournament, the gulf is just getting wider and wider between the likes of New Zealand, Australia, South Africa and the Six Nations countries and the likes of Samoa, as well as Fiji and Tonga as well.
Yeah, for sure. And I think there's a very clear before and after professionalism there as well. Like that's when the professional game started sort of in the Southern Hemisphere here. And like that's when the islands in general, even not just Samoa, got a little bit left behind somewhat.
Yeah, and obviously governance in the last few years has been a big issue when it comes to Samoan rugby and the finances as well. Is that still a crisis?
I don't think it's a crisis. Like, it's always a challenge. They sort of get by on what they get from World Rugby and like some minor local sponsorships and things. But yeah, I don't think it's at crisis point, but it's like no one's choosing to play for Samoa for the money, put it that way.
Mm-hmm. You say it's they get what they can out of World Rugby, but I think it's fairly obvious over the last few years what they're getting from World Rugby is very little, nowhere near enough. And even more recently, there was talk of the World League that World Rugby are trying to push through, and it looks like, you know, the likes of Samoa, Fiji, Tonga, countries that have put so much into the game down the years, or just being left behind in all of that.
Yeah, and that's a massive concern for the union and like the fans here and stuff. Is you know, this Nations Championship deal, whatever happens, like if it's the islands might get left out again. Like it's when the game moved to professionalism all over again, right? Like it's a chance to, I don't know if right the wrongs is the right thing to say, but to let the other nations like jump back up in the standings by giving them a slice of the pie. And it's concerning that there's talk of them being sort of locked out of that competition.
Yeah, and we are already seeing it when it comes to the world rankings, like you mentioned there. Samoa, 17th in the world now, behind the likes of Uruguay and the USA at the moment. They have been on a real slide over the last few years on the field.
Yeah, it's been rough. Like they've cycled through a bunch of coaches and stuff. It's been definitely a lean few years for Samoa. Of course, they barely made this World Cup there to go to like a last. Sort of last chance qualifier against Germany, and outclassed them. But you know, it was pretty fine there to them not being in the World Cup at all.
And like, what are the prospects at the World Cup? What's a realistic target for them? Because as you say, the slide has been fairly obvious over the last few years, just about qualifying, having to go through Germany. And like, I'm looking at the last 2-3 years, their only real wins have been against Germany, Spain, and Canada. Like, the prospects for them don't really look good in a pool with, you know, Ireland, Scotland, and Japan as well. Russia, that is a game where Samoa probably would expect to win. They're still ahead of Russia in the rankings, but overall the signs aren't really that promising for them, are they?
No, certainly not. Like, the most recent games, November tour last year, they had 2 losses and a win. The losses against the US and Georgia, they were pretty fairly close in those games, but I mean, even if you're close in those games, that's not adding up to a strong performance on the World Cup stage. I think the pool, though, I feel like it's almost a best-case scenario, maybe. Like, if Samoa are to, like, pull things together, Scotland maybe not the strongest sort of second team on paper. And then the other opposition is, like, if Samoa can get it together, then there's a chance they could... surprise, I think, but you know, we're not even sure what the squad's going to look like yet, so it's probably premature to talk about that, and we'll see what happens over the next few months.
Yeah, we are obviously quite a way out from the World Cup. Middle of September, we're only in the middle of June now. New coach came in last year, Steve Jackson. You mentioned, I was speaking to you earlier in the week about how there is the possibility when it comes to a World Cup squad of trying to pick out a couple of guys maybe playing in Super Rugby who could be qualified to play for Samoa.
Yeah, that's right. So we'll get a closer idea of what sort of team they'll take to the World Cup when they play the Pacific Nations Cup in a couple months. And like Steve's talked about, there's sort of 70 players on his sort of watch list, and those are guys all over the world, like in Northern Hemisphere, Super Rugby, and even there's a few local guys who are like on the radar, I guess, as well. A couple guys in Super Rugby who would be eligible and are like sort of possible wish list guys is someone like Melani Nanai, the fullback at the Blues. Mm-hmm. He's currently first in meters carried in the competition, and the only guy over 1,000 so far, so he's like lighting it up offensively. And he's a guy that's off to Worcester Warriors for next season. So he's sort of, I guess, you need guys that are like, have given up on the All Blacks, basically.
Yeah.
And like by moving to Europe, he's leaving New Zealand rugby behind. So that might indicate that he's interested in playing for Samoa, but we'll have to see.
Yeah, and obviously they do have a lot of, you know, household names playing in the Northern Hemisphere, the likes of Mulapola, Newcastle, Jack Lamb, Tusi Pisi, Ray Lilo, Tim Nanai-Williams, to name just a few of them. Like, we're talking about a team that have kind of fallen well down the rankings over the last few years, and the performances have been so far off what they were back in the great amateur days for Samoa and Western Samoa. But there is the core of what should be a pretty good team there, isn't there?
Yeah. Like these are all guys who have performed for years on the highest stage in Europe. Like you wonder whether they're perhaps getting old. Like I know there was a huge number of guys like off contract, coming off contract in the English Premiership this year. So whether it's like they've reached the end of this sort of generation maybe, and there's not enough new talent sort of pushing them and like coming through and cementing their place in the team. But there's some good names in there, and I think they've underperformed over the last few seasons.
And if this underperformance continues into a World Cup, and you know, if, for argument's sake, they are to finish bottom of a pool and lose to Russia and Japan and Scotland and Ireland, like, what happens next for them? Does the crisis just deepen for them on the pitch? Or, you know, is there a danger then they just continue to get left behind with the gulf we've seen in the last few years? And, you know, rugby in Samoa no longer has the kind of the legacy and the tradition we always associate it.
Yeah, I guess so. Like, it's pretty entrenched in, like, the fans now that the team has been a bit crap for a few years. And, you know, like, there's eventually the danger where kids aren't interested. Like, the blue shirt loses its meaning, I guess, eventually. And, you know, those losing years add up to people turning away from the team. But, like, we're not there yet, and the team is still... The people are still obsessed with the team. Like, we see it. There's been a relatively bit of success on the Sevens circuit recently. Like, they just finished sixth overall in the series. There's some really good tournaments down the back end of the year. So, and, like, people are really into that. So, you know, I don't think it's... Yeah. Maybe there's a slight danger it might go away eventually, but people are still dead keen on their rugby down here.
How big would the appetite be, we'll say, to get a couple of Super Rugby matches every year over in Samoa? I know they've played in Fiji in the last couple of years. I'm not certain if they've played in Samoa or not, but to get touring sides over there. I know Ireland have never, to the best of my knowledge, have never toured over there. The last team to really have played over there was, I think, Wales a number of years ago. Like, not just Samoa as well, the likes of Fiji and Tonga, they don't have the benefit of welcoming touring sides over to them. And naturally, that's going to have a knock-on effect.
Yeah, for sure. So they had the All Blacks were here in 2015, and then I think maybe that year and the year after there were Super Rugby games here. But it's been a while since there was a big game at Apia Park, I think. And you know, we've seen like Fiji hosting Super Rugby games the last few years, and there was one just last week, last weekend actually, and like it was packed out. And you know, it's probably not a financial sort of earner for those teams involved and like the unions and stuff. But you know, are we playing rugby for money, or you know, what's the aim of the game here? Like growth of the game and stuff. There's a lot of talk about that from. Like the New Zealand and Sanzai unions as well. And, you know, growth of the game, surely that would be involved, like, having a Super Rugby team in Samoa or playing a few games in Samoa at least, you know, more. Because it would make all the difference, having that top-flight stuff here.
Yeah, and, like, when you consider how much rugby has taken from the Pacific nations, it feels only natural that there should be some amount given back to them at the very least.
Oh, most definitely. Yeah, and that's why this rugby championship stuff, like the potential blocking out of island nations, is frustrating to say the least.
Okay, before we do go, Thomas, we're trying to get our kind of a couple of predictions really from everyone that we're going to have over the next few weeks. I just want to get overall winner for the tournament. Who's going to beat who in the final?
I mean, I can't not say New Zealand. So I'll say New Zealand beats Samoa in the final.
New Zealand against Samoa in the final. Perfect. That's a great answer. Thomas Airey, thanks for taking the time out to speak to us at what is a pretty unsociable hour, I'm absolutely certain, in Samoa. If you want to follow Tom leading up to the tournament, you can follow him on Twitter at Tom Airey Journo. So TOMAIREY Journo. Thomas, thanks a million for joining us on Land of the Rising Scrum.
Thank you guys so much for having me. It's been an absolute pleasure.
That was Thomas Airey there, rugby writer for the Samoa Observer. And just a reminder as well, our rugby coverage on Off the Ball is brought to you by Vodafone, team of us, everyone in. Time now to speak to a veteran of 42 Test caps and 2 Rugby World Cups, former Samoa second row, and current CEO of the Pacific Rugby Players Welfare Group, Dan Leo. Thanks for joining us this afternoon, Dan.
Thanks for having me. Pleasure to be here.
I'm going to get into your work, obviously, with the Pacific Rugby Players Welfare Group in a little while. But first of all, though, I just want to talk about your own experiences playing for Samoa and playing at the Rugby World Cup. Obviously, you were born and grew up in New Zealand. I read an interview recently enough where You were talking about the Israel Folau situation, and there was just one line in it in particular that stuck with me. You just kind of mentioned that how someone like Folau would have been raised into a Pacific Island community despite the fact that he was born in Australia, and as you say, you might as well be in the islands if you're in that situation. Obviously, you were born in New Zealand, obviously, although of Samoan descent. Is that something that would have resonated for you very much? It's just, you're in one country, you're in New Zealand, but you're almost living a Samoan, a Pacific Island life.
Yeah, exactly. We see it not just in the Pacific communities, but in a lot of the expat communities around the world. You know, here in the UK, you know, people have migrated here, find little pockets and stick together, and are supported by the community. You know, they find comfort and solace and being sticking to their community. So we do that exactly in the Pacific Islands. You know, I grew up in Auckland, which was a real hotbed of, you know, the biggest population of Pacific Islanders in the world now. But, you know, closely followed by Sydney. And, yeah, having experienced that, you know, I grew up as a proud New Zealander, but very much in touch with my Samoan heritage, you know, the language. And actually, you know, in those communities, sometimes you hold on to your culture a lot stronger than even when you're at home. So what I've noticed is that, you know, that the Samoan culture and heritage is a lot more stronger and prevalent outside of Samoa than it is, you know, necessarily in Samoa. That's the nature of life, I guess. And yeah, it does make it interesting in the Folau situation, though.
Mm-hmm. Specifically on the Rugby World Cup, though, Samoa's great Rugby World Cup was 1991 when they shocked Wales and got to the quarterfinals. I'm guessing you would have been probably around 8 or 9, I'm guessing, around that stage. There would have been in that team a lot of New Zealand-born players there, Pat Lam, Peter Fadialofa, and a few more as well. And obviously the great Brian Williams was involved with the coaches. As a young kid of Samoan heritage growing up in New Zealand, seeing those guys who would have had a pretty similar story to yourself, is that something that would have resonated with you as a kid?
Yeah, definitely. I still remember it really clearly. My dad waking me up at 3 or 4 in the morning for the to watch Samoa's games across the world in the World Cup from here in the UK. And you know, we and Samoa being the first the first team that I supported from that young age, and really, you know, just getting behind the underdog, and just, you know, what that team did for us as young Samoans growing up, particularly in New Zealand, where you know, there is a risk of losing your identity. It was a massive thing, you know. And guys like you know, for me now in my career, I still lean on guys like that, like you know, your Michael Jones, your Pat Lambs, you know, some of the guys that Apollo Perolini, Junior Paramore is on the Pacific Rugby Players Welfare Board. So it's great to see those guys. You know, not only did they make their mark on Pacific Island rugby back then in the 90s, but they're still making that, and they're still contributing to our communities now, and really trying to make the, you know, life easier for the next generation of players coming over here, particularly to place, you know, places like Europe and Japan.
And I imagine then an enormous honour when the chance came for you to pull on the Samoa jersey.
Yeah, of course it was. You know, it's something that you really cherish, particularly, I think, when it's gone, when your career's when you can't play international rugby anymore. And I look back with really fond memories on the whole time. You know, I was lucky enough to play for over a 10-year period for Samoa. Only accrued, you know, under 50 caps. You know, I look at some of the guys that I played with, you know, your James Haskell's, you know, etc., who played for England for that long and probably, you know, got closer to 100 caps. But, you know, it presents its own challenges. Playing for the Pacific sides isn't easy, but, you know, it's probably one of the most fulfilling, you know, the most fulfilling nations you can play for as well.
Yeah, you played at 2 World Cups, 2007 and 2011. You retired a few months before 2015, and I was reading up on that in the last couple of days. Shortly before you retired from international rugby, you had kind of been speaking about the fact that so many players from not just Samoa, from Fiji as well and Tonga as well, there's a lot of pressure on them to step aside from the international game coming up towards a contract negotiations with clubs and moving on to new clubs. Was that something that was, you know, very much your case?
For me, it was more, I've been outspoken as a senior player in 2014 around some of the issues, the mismanagement issues that we had in our union. We really wanted to confront as a senior players group some of the, you know, the corruption that we had, that we had been provided evidence of. And, you know, myself being sort of at the forefront of that movement, there was a few of us that were branded as troublemakers within the Samoan side for really asking those, you know, those questions. So for me, it was more of a case of jumping before I got pushed
on. Yeah.
And you know, it did take a toll. You know, 2014 took a massive toll on me, probably more mentally than physically. You know, when you're in a culture like ours, I was asking questions of the hierarchy and of senior politicians. You know, we're in the position where our prime minister is the chairman of the Samoan Union, similar in Fiji. So you know, it was a tough time period in my life, and I just thought, you know, after 2014, I was probably mentally tired. I didn't feel like I was in the, and so I guess the whole World Cup experience and international experience have been tarnished a bit for me by that period. And you sort of, the longer in the game, you sort of closer you get to the top, you realise, you know, that things aren't all rosy. You know, it's not all a bed of roses at the top. There are some issues that need addressing. And I sort of saw that as an opportunity for me to move into that, you know, straight away. And I didn't, you know, I wanted, you know, I think I wanted the team to be able to go to the World Cup with a fresh slate. And you can't be carrying that sort of baggage into a World Cup. So as I say, it was probably a decision that I could come to before, you know, a few months before. But I don't think they would pick me anyway. So it was an easy retirement for me.
Was it, you say it's an easy retirement, but was it a difficult decision to come to?
Yeah, of course it was. You know, everyone wants to play in the World Cup, and that's the pinnacle of everyone's career. I was, you know, I guess blessed and fortunate in the ways that I already played in two World Cups. So, you know, I was at the end of my career, and you want to, you know, every player wants to be able to leave the jersey in a better place than they pick it up in. And for me, that was a way, you know, by not shying away from those issues and actually trying to make a stand before we got to the World Cup in 2015 was, you know, almost my way of saying, look, you know, we can actually do something special here. We've got the players, we've got the people behind us, but really there's a whole lot of back off-field issues that were holding us back that, you know, for us to put our best foot forward as a squad, you know, they needed confronting. And unfortunately, they needed someone to spearhead that movement, and that was myself, you know, strongly supported by some of the other, you know, Census Johnston, David Lemmy, Murray Fasavalu, Tusi Pisi, you know, a whole, you know, group of senior players that got to know each other very well. And you know, at the time we were I think ranked seventh or eighth in the world. You know, we'd just come off a tour in South Africa, we've beaten Scotland and Italy, and then come back and beaten Wales in Cardiff, you know, less than 12 months later. So we were really at our pinnacle, I think. And it was sad to sort of have to, you know, to not be involved in that and just not to see us really, I think, you know, fulfill our potential as a squad. But as I say, you know, there's sometimes in rugby and in sport, there's bigger issues, and you've got to think about, you know, the next generations that are coming behind you. And you know, realistically, the chance to do that was then in 2014-15, because you know, while you're in the squad, you've got an influence. When you're out of it, you know, it's difficult. And I think you know, naturally at the end of 2015, you know, they'll probably look at making a turnover of some of those senior players anyway. So we had to move then. As you say, it's unfortunate because you know, personally, I would have loved to have been there, but you know, it raises questions. And you know, a big part of my role now is really confronting these issues and the politics, you know, the influence of politicians and stuff that occurs in the islands and isn't really an issue for many other countries. And really trying to you know, affect change and getting, you know, groups like World Rugby, you know, as the governing body, to enforce the change that we need to really be able to step into the potential that we know is there in the Pacific Islands.
Just to go back though on the issue of players kind of being pressurised into, you know, stepping away from international rugby, I haven't seen a huge amount of Samoa players in the last year or so. You can correct me on that, but certainly this year with Fiji, the likes of Nagusa and Nemani Nadolo as well have both, within a few days of each other, announced their retirements from international rugby in a World Cup year shortly after signing a new contract with their clubs.
Yeah. I mean, Nemanja Nadolo sits on the Pacific Rugby Players Welfare Board, and we've discussed that. I think I'm not sure around the circumstances of Nagusa, but everyone's got there's different things that play all the time, and for us as Pacific Islands, the financial it's the financial aspect of the game is for a lot of us is why we while we play. For so long in our careers, and while we make the sacrifice of moving away from our families, is to support them. But also, it's why we play so well. When you've got, the pressure can be sort of a catch-22, because, it can be something that holds you back. But if you work it in the right way, it can be something that really propels you forward. But outside of those two, I'm coming across you, and I just discussed with another player in France who's been thrown, offered incredible amounts of money to not go to the World Cup. And at the moment, Regulation 9 doesn't allow for that. They can't stop you from going to the World Cup. But nothing to say that we're not going to, we're not going to give you an extra 15,000 euros per month on top of what the 30 a month that you're already getting to stop you from going. And that's a difficulty, again, that's something that probably needs to be addressed for the credibility of obviously the World Cup and also the sport. You want your best players to be to be there, and if some of these Pacific Island teams are going to be, and not just Pacific Island teams, tier two nations, I'd go as far as saying it's going to be competitive, and it's going to be, and we're looking at growing the game. Then you need the best players to be there, and definitely that's something that's hindering, that's hindering the game from developing as it should.
And I imagine this sort of an issue is exactly the type of thing that would have prompted you to set up the Pacific Players Welfare Group a few years ago.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we probably set this up more to deal with some of the underlying issues of this that are raised by this migration of players, this mass migration of players of Pacific Island heritage to Europe, there's a number of factors behind that. We've got 800 players across France alone now. Nearly over 1,000 players playing professionally or semi-professional throughout Europe. And with that, poses a lot of issues, especially in those lower divisions where guys aren't getting, the financial remuneration that the top guys are getting. But they've got the similar demands from the families, a financial expectation. But they don't have the support networks around them to really thrive under that. So we set up, myself and the other, key Pacific Island players from around the world really set up this organization to give back to them, to those guys who are really chasing the dream. But within that, we've had to take on, and look at the causal factors behind that, really the root causes of this migration, which, as I touched on earlier, is the lack of a professional pathway in the Pacific. The financial share, the fact that all the money now lies in the European competitions, and it is a long way from home for guys. Social isolation, loneliness leads to those two things alone. The cultural differences, the language difficulties, lead to all sorts of areas. And in the worst instances, we've seen a number of guys take their own players take their own lives. But between that and the top level, there's a lot of people who are, they may not be drowning, but they're definitely sinking. And we really wanted to touch on that by setting, so we've set up specialist mental health services, particularly, with counsellors who are used and have a rapport with Pacific Island players, but really breaking the stigma around that. We spent 4 days in Lourdes, just returned from France, where we gathered all, 400 of the players and families in Lourdes, the spiritual capital of France, last weekend, to really talk about some of these issues. And really, that's where we see our, we are advocates for change at the top level, because, we have to, unless we get a better deal from the governing body of World Rugby, nothing's going to change. But we really see it as a two-pronged attack, supporting the players who are coming here en masse, and also affecting the policy that really has impacted and really we see as the causal factor of this tide of players and families away from the Pacific Islands, particularly to Europe.
Yeah, and like you mentioned World Rugby there, obviously, in the last few months. You in particular would have been quite outspoken on the plans for this Nations Championship or Nations League that World Rugby are trying to drive through. Initially, you had suggested that Pacific Nations and Tier 2 Nations should boycott the Rugby World Cup. Since then, we've had a few more details come through. There's been talk of a promotion relegation system. Are you still quite sceptical on the way this tournament would work if it was pushed through?
Oh yeah, I am. You know, anything that's driven by the bottom line and money, I'm skeptical of, because you know, that's not rugby. You know, rugby has never been a sport that's, you know, been you know, the decision making process has, you know, been purely financially driven, and it's a dangerous place to be, I think, if that's, you know, the sole factor that you're making decisions and driving competitions on. I understand that money is important. But you know, any sort of competition that looks at ring fencing and enhancing, you know, the difference between tiers 1 and 2 and 3 is detrimental in my point of view. If anything, we should be trying to bring up, you know, get rid of the tier systems, not trying to enforce them and make those gaps greater. And yeah, I mean, for us, as you know, as Tonga and Samoa, you know, Fiji, if they're in that competition, it's great for them. But you know, for anyone that's not inside it, I can't see it, you know, it's being too great. But again, you know, I like to think that those conversations are, you know, are being had around that top governing table. But yeah, it's all a little bit too grey, really. And until we see a few more details around financial share of that competition, then it's hard to pass judgment. But initially, when it came out, when it was just, you know, looking at ring fencing, I think the competition, you know, the top 10 nations for up to 10 years, it didn't look good, did it?
No, certainly not. How far away do you think we are from seeing one of the tier one nations, the big countries, I'm talking New Zealand, South Africa, Australia, Six Nations teams, going on a tour of the Pacific Islands?
But to be honest, I think that reality is getting further and further away. You know, in the last 20 years, I think no one's been to Tonga, and there are, you know, Tonga's a top 12. I think they're in the top 15 nations of the world, but they haven't had any tier one nations visit them in almost 20 years. For me, that's not good enough. You know, if we're looking at growing the game, the top nations have got to visit the smaller, you know, the developing nations. It's the only way that you're going to grow the exposure in those nations, and also give young players the hope that they aren't out in the dark, and the goodwill that would do for the sport would be amazing. But we just haven't seen that in the last last 10 years. I understand they're looking at coming out with the next 10-year schedule fairly soon, and as soon as this nation's championship is organised, but yeah, any competition again that, you know, that locks out and doesn't ensure that there's opportunities for tier two nations to play against and actually beat the tier ones. You know, I look at back in my career and beating the Wallabies in Australia and beating Wales and France are great, but you know, come to Samoa, you know, come to Samoa and play us there, and you know, and we'll see. You know, I always like to, you know, think back to my career, and if we'd had, you know, if we'd played England and Samoa, I like to think we all got a lot closer than, you know, than when, in 2014 when we lost 28 points to 6, I think it was, or something like that. So but yeah, I mean, it throws up a lot of questions, but I like to see, you know, and I think if you ask the players, you speak to the players and the fans, they'd love, you know, English players and fans would love to come to Samoa, Fiji, or Tonga and experience the culture, and just the, you know, but unfortunately at the moment they're being deprived of that opportunity, and it's sad, really.
Yeah, I can't imagine there's any players of the big Six Nations or Sanzar countries that wouldn't love to go and play a tour over in the Pacific Islands. Just finally, before you go as well, I just wanted to mention the Oceans Apart series that you would have released in the last couple of weeks. The first video with Rupeni Kitautau. You obviously played him on the Pacific Islands tour where you got 3 of your test caps. What else have you got coming up in these videos? The first one was absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. We set out to make a documentary, and that's still very much the case. It's called The Oceans Apart, the story of Pacific Rugby, which is really looking at the governance and all the challenges that we've just spoken about, and how we can how the Pacific Islands can navigate and survive, I guess, in the professional era. But outside of that, we had 35 hours of footage. With a whole host of, you know, all of the top names in Pacific Rugby we got interviews with. So, you know, guys from Vainga Tuingamala to Nicky Gonover to Pat Lamb to Talupu Falatau, you name it, you know, they're in there. But getting all of that into 1 hour, to an hour 20 documentaries are very difficult. So yeah. We've decided to release the Oceans Apart series to promote the release of the documentary later on in the year, and it's individual stories really. It's exciting. You know, there's lots of, you know, and everyone. I think that's, you know, the wider picture is, you know, it is a rich story, and everyone's coming from different places. We speak to Samisa Rokodoguni about his decision to play for England instead of Fiji, and how that was received back at home in the islands. And I speak to Charles Piertel about, you know, his journey coming through the All Blacks. So there's the whole range of different stories, and, you know, really rich stories, and that are unraveled in the series. But I guess it's just really raising the awareness around all the issues that that Pacific Island rugby face, and then through that the raising of the awareness, hopefully we can affect and the change, the policy change that we need to really flourish.
Okay, for anyone who wants to watch that video on Rupeni Thaisau, you can catch it on Twitter at Pacific Welfare, and we'll keep an eye out as well for the rest of these videos as and when they come. Dan Leo, thanks a million for joining us this afternoon.
Brilliant. No, been a pleasure. Thanks again.
Take care. That's it for Land of the Rising Scrum this week. We've now completed Pool A, 4 episodes down. Still 15 more to come, though, as we get through Pools B, C and D. You can listen back to the podcast of this on offtheball.com. Or you can watch it on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/offtheball. We'll be back for more next week.
The Land of the Rising Scrum on Off the Ball.